This is an Audio Wool original.
Hello there.
Hey, Tony, this is Kelly. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Thank you so much for finding time for us. I don't know how much background Byron gave you when you guys connected by email, but we have a podcast and we talk about various, you know, true crime and some kind of conspiracy related things. And this summer we're trying to cover some, you know, perhaps less covered topics related to Scientology. Thankfully, there's been so much media out there in the last few years that really covers the core and certainly some of the personal stories related to it. But we're trying to, I guess, investigate some of the other things related. And obviously, you are the authority. So I'm really glad we were able to connect. You know, just looking back through your history, I know the first, at least I believe, the first story you wrote about Scientology was in the Phoenix Times back in like 95. Is that right?
Phoenix New Times.
Okay. And tell me, what did you know about Scientology before this? I know you grew up in LA, so I'm sure you encountered it at some point. But what was the entry point for you into this topic?
Well, I guess when you grow up in LA, you have to have some awareness of it. I mean, it's hard to avoid. And I don't know, I'd read some things. I remember when Hubbard died, I think I read something in the paper. And So there was some awareness of it. And I had read some of the myths, like there's this myth that Hubbard started Scientology on a bet with Robert Heinlein.
I actually haven't heard that one.
Yeah, and I had heard that before I knew anything really about Scientology. I'd heard, oh, some guy started on a bet. Well, that's not true. But it's one of these persistent things that never goes away. There's always I always run into people that say, you know, Scientology was started on a bet.
Right.
It's not true. But anyway, I had this sort of awareness of it. So I had found myself in Phoenix working for this wonderful, wonderful newspaper. And it gave me a lot of freedom to choose what I wanted to write about. And one of the things that we did was we tried to find stories that the daily paper had either missed or done badly.
Oh.
And that was not a difficult thing to do in Phoenix because the Arizona Republic was so wretched. And one day I was just looking through the Republic letters to the editor and I spotted this letter from a guy that said, yeah, you covered my trial, my lawsuit that I lost, but you didn't mention that the plaintiff against me had been recruited by the Church of Scientology. And I thought, wow, that sounds kind of juicy.
Interesting.
So I called this guy up. His name was Rick Ross. He's a nationally known cult expert. And at that time, he was sort of well known, but nobody had ever done like a full profile on him. And so
Does he do deprogramming for cult members, like when they get out?
Well, he did. Okay. Did in the 90s. But he's just, you know, he's called in all the time to talk about various groups. And he's really sort of, his expertise is in Bible-based groups. But he also dealt with Scientology a certain amount. And so they went after him. And so I got to write this wonderful cover story about all these groups that were after him. Like, that was the first story that really connected Scientology and the Branch Davidians, for example.
Okay.
The Scientologist found out that he was deprogramming a very important former Branch Davidian. And so this was before all the, you know, raid and everything.
Right.
Scientology got word to David Koresh that Rick Ross was doing this. And Rick is convinced it's because they assume, because Scientology doesn't kill people. Scientology likes to really mess with people, but they don't outright kill people. But they probably thought that Koresh would do it.
Right.
So that was a fun little thing to report on.
Oh,
so that
God.
Was my first story. It was my first cover story for that paper. It kind of really clinched my getting a full-time job there. So it was a very important story for me, and I really enjoyed it. In that kind of a publication, sort of a magazine-style journalism, over time, you're allowed to kind of develop an expertise. And so that was just the first of, you know, several stories that I did there. And then I moved to the Los Angeles paper back home, and that's a great place to work on Scientology stories. So I did some really, really fun stories there, like the story of Tori Christman, which is a great story about how she came out of Scientology. And so I was just, and it just over time, it became something that I specialized in.
Great. Wow, that's fantastic. And I knew bits and pieces of that, but a lot of that is new. I had no idea about the Koresh connection. That's really fascinating and makes perfect sense when you phrase it that way. Geez. So, you know, I have to admit that it's really, I've danced around Scientology forever because I think it's just part of our cultural awareness these days. But in terms of any in-depth research, I've really only started in the last few months. And so I've got a long way to go. But one of the things I have noticed after listening to some of the actual audio of Hubbard's teachings, particularly some of his more esoteric ones, I know everybody says he was super charismatic and that people just flocked to him as a leader. I'm trying to wrap my head around it because he wasn't by any accounts this super attractive guy, right? And I'm listening to the stories he tells, and it's funny you brought up the sci-fi writer connection, but I'm like, he's not even that great of a storyteller. Like, some of these stories he's coming up with just don't seem that great to me. What do you think it was about Hubbard, you know, based on the research you've done, that really drew people to him?
Yeah, I had that same reaction too, because I had always read how charismatic he was and how great his timing was. And there was a book that came out, the first, you know, book put out by a mass publisher came out in 2006, and it went on and on about how perfect his timing was and how he could work a room and everything. And I hadn't really heard that many lectures, directly at that point. But then I started doing that more, especially in the last few years. I've listened to a lot of his lectures, and I just don't hear it. I mean, the guy is just such a crank. And he's laughing at his audience. I mean, he's challenging them to believe the most ridiculous things. You can tell that he's like, how far can I push these people?
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
And you're right. You read some women in the early, I mean, there are some photos of him in the 40s where he cuts somewhat of a dashing figure. But by the 50s and 60s, I mean, this guy, I don't know. I don't get it. I guess he was one of these people that, he was telling them I will give him this credit. He was telling them things they weren't hearing anywhere else. I mean, this is Eisenhower America, right?
Right, right.
And it was the most conservative social scene ever in this country. And here's this guy talking about how actually we're just these sort of like trapped souls in this mass space opera narrative going on in the galaxy.
Right.
And this was a generation that had just survived the Great Depression and then World War II. And I think normal everyday life was difficult for them to adapt to. And they wanted something bigger and larger now that they had survived these incredible ordeals and America was now the greatest country in the world. And here was this guy saying, well, we can readapt our brains to travel across the galaxy.
Right.
And that really struck a nerve. So in that sense, his timing was very good. But I think if you separate yourself out from that and just listen to the lectures, as Russell Miller has said, who wrote the best biography of the man, once you start to learn about who this guy actually was, it's hard to believe that anybody ever took him seriously at all.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I'm at. It just seems so ridiculous, 90% of what he's saying, and also his background and the lies he stacks upon lies. And, you know, of course, it's easy as an outsider to look in and see, for example, the Sea Org ads and this weird naval theme that runs throughout everything and then hear about his naval history. It just seems like he was trying to overcome some, you know, great embarrassment he had for his own naval career. And so he was going to prove it in this way. And this many people have gotten on board and stayed on board for so long is just astonishing to me.
He's a fascinating guy because, I mean, if you go all the way back to his childhood and look at what he went through, you know, from the beginning, his parents were treating him like he was some kind of special being, you know. He rose to that. I mean, he thought of himself that way, too. By the time he was in high school, he was already really striking people as a unique individual, incredibly ambitious, very smart. And, you know, some people saw through it. Right from the beginning, there were people that would say, this guy is such a, you know, liar.
Right.
You know, it became part of his being that he actually did live in interesting times and did amazing things, but that was never good enough. He would always then layer on all these embellishments. All along, like I said, there would always be an observer, whether it was in the 40s, 50s, 60s, or 70s, there would always be somebody saying, man, we could see right through this guy. He was so full of it. But other people they loved it. And they loved this guy that would take over a party and spin these wild tales. And they did fall under his spell. There's no question.
It is fascinating to watch. I mean, it's an interesting study in human psychology, if nothing else. But I suppose, you know, that's probably the truth with any great charismatic leader of people. whether it be a church or a cult or, you know, whatever you want to call it, which is another interesting thing. I've heard in a lot of interviews with you that you really try to stay away from calling it a cult, because from at least my understanding of what you're saying is that it really doesn't seem to serve much of a purpose to drill down on this idea that it's a cult. Whatever it calls itself, let's focus on what it's doing.
Yeah, it's just a bad word because it's so inexact. I mean, people just say, well, it's not a church, it's a cult. Well, what's it called? I mean, right. You go to certain academics like, you know, Rick Ross and some other professors, they will sit down and give you these definitions. But that's not what most people use it as. It's just a derogatory word for a religion they don't like. And right. I just stay away from that argument. Keep in mind, when he first brought out his book that started all this, the title was Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health. And he sold it as a science. And to this day, longtime Scientologists will tell you that all they were ever doing was a science, and all the stuff about a church and a religion was just for tax purposes.
Right. That was one of the things I found interesting too. Is it right that he originally took Dianetics to groups of psychiatrists and psychologists in the country and they rejected it, and that's one of the reasons he has or had such a grudge against psychology?
Yeah, I mean, go back a little further. I mean, he came through the war. He had a disastrous war experience, but of course he told everybody that he practically won the thing on his own.
Right.
And then by 1947, he was in such bad shape. He came home from the war and went to the hospital. And what he told people was that he'd literally been machine gunned in Indonesia. But we have his medical records. He had hemorrhoids, right? He had like a bad knee or something. I can't remember. But it was conjunctivitis. That's right. Pink eye.
Yeah, pink eye. Yep.
He was depressed. And in 1947, he wrote this very revealing letter because he was being, you know, he'd been demobilized by like so many other soldiers. And he wanted, you know, one of the things is what am I going to get paid now? He wrote this letter in 1947 begging for psychiatric help. I mean, he talks about how he's just losing it and he's in such bad mental health. And as far as I know, he never got that help.
Oh, wow.
Within 2 years, he's now writing this book claiming to have completely figured out how the human mind works. So 2 years after admitting that he's at his rope's end and he's, you know, he's mentally ill, 2 years later, he claims to be the world expert on how the human mind works. And he had managed to convince a small group of pretty smart people that he was onto something. And they really encouraged him to approach the AMA and the APA, mm-hmm. to approach these groups of medical professionals with these ideas, and they were, of course, roundly rejected. He was bitter about that. And so, you know, the rest of his life, he demonized psychiatry and mainstream medicine, and that drove away some of those early, you know, proponents. Like, he had physicians and some engineers that were behind him initially, and again, he was selling a science. But then Dianetics was this big popular success in 1950. But by 1951, he was broke.
Right.
And he lost the use of the name Dianetics in bankruptcy.
Oh.
Yeah, that's why he had to come up with a new name.
In 1952
in Wichita and then Phoenix, he started over again and came up with the name Scientology. Now, he convinced this Wichita millionaire to come along, and he took care of the bankruptcy and he got the name Dianetics back, but he'd already switched to this word Scientology. And the difference between Dianetics and Scientology is Dianetics, the idea is you have various traumas in your life going back to when you were in your mother's womb. You need to remember, you have to go back and recover those memories of what it was like to be a sperm, an egg, a zygote, a fetus, all these terrible things that happened because your parents had rough sex or whatever. And then this will magically erase something called the reactive mind and make you this incredible human being with high IQ, total recall, all this magical stuff that he promised Dianetics. By the time he came up with Scientology 2 years later, the people he was working with weren't satisfied just to remember back to their childhood or being a fetus. They wanted to go back farther.
Right.
Into the idea of past lives.
And that's where it crossed from science.
That's the big difference between the two, right? So this is what Paul Thomas Anderson was actually dramatizing in his movie The Master. He was intrigued by that idea where Hubbard was going from the one to the other, and early followers like the one portrayed by Laura Dern were not ready to make that leap from something that seemed like a science based on your own memories to this idea of past lives. memories that are thousands or millions of years old? That just seemed like science fiction. And so he lost some of those early followers. One of them was actually a science fiction writer. His name was A.E. Van Vogt, who spent the rest of his life still doing Dianetics. But he couldn't go on to Scientology with some of these other followers. So he starts Scientology in 52, but it's still a disaster. He's still not making any money. In 1953, he writes this letter to a close follower by the name of suddenly went out of my head. Very important letter. O'Brien was her last name, but I'm forgetting what her first name is. So he writes this letter to her and says, listen, we can't do any worse than we are right now. Maybe we should try out the religion angle. And he literally says it that way, the religion angle.
Wow.
Later that year, December 1953, Hubbard and his wife, his son and her wife, and another couple filed papers in Camden, New Jersey for the first Church of Scientology Corporation. A couple of months later, in February 1954, some of his followers started up a Church of Scientology in Los Angeles. For some reason, Scientology always says that's the beginning of the Church of Scientology, but you can actually see the incorporation papers. The real beginning is December 53 in Camden, New Jersey.
Wow.
And so since then, he started calling it a church. And again, there were people that were just assuming, oh, this is a tax thing. He actually got tax-exempt status in, I think, 57, but then lost it in 67.
Right.
Because the courts decided, look, this is a business, and it's benefiting L. Ron Hubbard. It's not a church. And they stripped him of that tax-exempt status.
It was funny because not only were we criticizing psychiatrists now, but you see the IRS find their way into some of the narratives. And I love the part of the Xenu story about them calling people in for income tax audits. Like, it's wild. And you're listening to the people in the audience, and you're like, surely they aren't believing this. This is the most poorly made up, on the fly story I've ever heard. And yet, oh my gosh, people are eating it up.
Well, that's the thing, is if a science fiction writer, a good science fiction writer, and he wrote some decent science fiction, if a good science fiction writer was going to turn science fiction into a religion, you'd think they would spend a little time and do a heck of a lot better than what Hubbard did. I mean, it's terrible science fiction.
It is. And that's one of the questions I had. And maybe this has to do with the mental health problems he was having. But I have read reports that he was into some pretty bad drugs at that point, like, you know, in the mid late 60s, and that he was coming off of one of those drug dips, I guess, when he came and did the assists lecture on the Apollo. Is there any truth to those stories? Was he into some drug problems, do you think?
Well, the assists lecture came after when he actually wrote that stuff. He wrote it in a hotel room in the Canary Islands. He supposedly wrote a letter at that time. He did write a letter at that time mentioning Pinks and Grays. John Atack, who's a real expert and a real historian, will tell you that, yes, Hubbard was a constant drug user and various drugs. Other people will say no, they didn't see him drink in front of him. But I think he definitely was using drugs at that time. But, you know, if you're trying to excuse Xenu as some kind of drug event, I would say just look at his fiction, because some of his science fiction is that bad. So, you know, it was kind of consistent with the stuff he came up with in other places. I mean, we found a couple. There's a book coming out in a couple of months by a fine writer by the name of Alec Navala Lee. And he really got into Hubbard's fiction and how it relates to Scientology. And I really enjoyed that book.
Ooh,
people will
have to get that.
But I've also looked at some stories myself that, you know, have some uncanny connections. There's one story in particular. Chuck Beatty always asked me, told me, Tony, you need to read this story. And I did, and it blew me away. In 1940, he was predicting this future where these evil cults had taken over the country. And I mean, it's uncanny. Oh. I mean, he had this whole idea that there were these occult-based cults that were able to literally destroy the existence of objects simply with the power of the mind.
Wow.
I mean, it's incredible. He had thought about this stuff for a long time.
Wow. So interesting. Well, the other thing that I've started to feel too, as I look through at least a general timeline of Scientology, is Hubbard, in my opinion, was pretty nuts and had some pretty wild ideas and took people on some real interesting journeys. You know, and the whole premise behind it and manipulating people and taking their money is pretty evil. But it almost seems like with the transition of power to Miscavige, it got even worse. I mean, that's where perhaps that's because the modern stories that we're reading about all the torn apart families and the horrible other things come under Miscavige's power. But do you think there was a shift in the tone of the church? Like, did it get worse, or is that just a perception I'm mistakenly seeing?
Well, I mean, think about the time we're talking about, 60s and 70s. There were a lot of experiments in alternate communities and,
right,
you know, metaphysical ideas about the universe. And the unfortunate thing with Hubbard was that, you know, he was another one of these people that was proposing wild things like you could become a god and take over the universe and all this stuff. But he combined that with a guy who was really a fascist. I mean, the guy was extremely right-wing and totally paranoid. And in the beginning, in about the mid-60s, he became so paranoid about people stealing his ideas that the major thrust of Scientology in the 60s and 70s became all about control, just ruling people's lives and interrogating people. So, yes, Miscavige has basically followed those things, but they come from Hubbard.
Okay.
I mean, for every story about families being ripped apart by Miscavige, people being interrogated, people being impoverished and, you know, investigated, I can give you a matching story that it happened under Hubbard. Now they have a different personal style. Lots of people that worked with Hubbard have told me that, you know, he could push people and be really ruthless, but then he knew when to stop and sort of pat you on the back,
right,
and tell a joke and lighten the mood and say, hey, thanks for working hard. And just that one little pat on the back would be good for like the next 2 years,
right,
of around the clock work. You know, you got a pat on the back from the old man. He was really good that way. Miscavige has none of those skills.
Yeah.
All he knows is to enforce the rules, be as ruthless as possible. And he's very good at, Hubbard was too, but Miscavige is really good at engendering that kind of ruthlessness between people so that, you know, Mike Rinder's talked about this. If you didn't attack your fellow worker for not doing a hard job, they're going to attack you. So, you know, a lot of the ruthlessness and bitterness and screaming and physicality wasn't necessarily coming from Miscavige, but from the other workers who you were around, I mean, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So it's just this horrible totalitarian, bitter thing that has festered under Miscavige. And in the sense of tone, I think he's just less he's just really relentless in a way that Hubbard might have let up once in a while.
Right. You know, obviously the stories we hear about crimes seem to center around the modern era, probably just because people weren't paying as close attention back in the day. But one of the things that I see is the power struggle, obviously, and very clearly Miscavige is in power. But it seems like your average parishioner has basically no power. One could argue that they enter of their own accord, but it seems that a lot of circumstances lead people to a position where that becomes their only choice or their best option in their own mind. Other than Miscavige and I guess Shelley, who I'd love to hear more about where you think the hell she is right now, but who else is in that circle of power? I mean, you hear the celebrities, like, do the celebrities actually fall within the circle of power like Miscavige, or are they, you know, so far down the ranks that they aren't in that same circle?
Well, that's one of the things that is very interesting about Miscavige. In the 90s, there was a pretty healthy contingent of upper level executives around him. So that while there was no question he was in charge, you had people like Marty Rathbun, who was this hardcore enforcer of his, Mike Rinder, who was running the Operation Office of Special Affairs and, you know, who would go on camera and talk to, you know, reporters, just all these various upper level executives. My own theory is that something having to do with the Lisa McPherson case and winning that case and settling the lawsuit gave Miscavige the feeling that he was kind of untouchable. And right at that period in 2004, after the last of that lawsuit was done and when Tom Cruise was being recovered and really pumped up to as gung-ho as possible, Miscavige turned his sort of ruthlessness at his own people and decimated those executive corps, drove away all these top executives. He had actually literally imprisoned many of them in this office prison they called the Hole that lasted for years and years. I mean, there were people. It was at its worst for about a 5-year period from 2004 to 2009 when the press was first revealed its existence. In that 5 years, there were, you know, 70 to 100 executives literally in this prison every day. and they couldn't leave. Now, since then, it's changed somewhat. He got caught basically by the press, and he's ameliorated it to a certain extent. Right. It's not as bad now. But there are still people that are in that segregated group that have been there now for 14 years. So the question then becomes, who does he have around him if he's, you know, turned all of these former top executives into prisoners, or they've gone away? You know, Amy Scobie and Jefferson Hawkins and Mike Rinder.
Yeah.
There was a defector who came out in late 2013, and I interviewed him a couple of years ago. His name is Paul Burkhart. He's really fascinating guy because he was right in the nerve center of all this, the Hollywood Guarantee Building on Hollywood Boulevard. Mm. And he was saying that Miscavige has done such a job of destroying the upper levels of management that there's really nobody left. He's got like this little contingent of like five people around him, like his driver and his personal communicator that are, you know, kind of handle all of his personal stuff. And then there's just like no second layer of management. He said, in fact, there's one woman in Hollywood that if she wasn't there, the place just wouldn't run. And that was the situation like 2 years ago. In the last couple of months, I noticed there was some events they held, and there were some younger executives that he allowed to go on stage. Now, this is a big deal. Hmm. Miscavige does not share the stage very often. And this is what's called Maiden Voyage. He actually had four young male executives in their 30s or 40s actually get up and speak, which I thought might be an indication that he's finally starting to groom another set of executives. Now, the two recent defectors both cautioned me on that and said, don't read too much into it. It just might be that he's wants somebody else to speak on stage. So we don't know yet. I mean, these are the kind of things that we're just sort of reading the tea leaves. It's a little criminology, you know. We're just trying to find out. It's hard to know exactly. But this is a question I get all the time. If something happens to Miscavige, who takes over?
Exactly.
But see, Hubbard never thought of that either. Hubbard never sat down and thought about succession. And I think that's one of the characteristics of a megalomaniac. They can never conceive of themselves not being there running things.
Right.
So Miscavige just had to, you know, push his way to the top after Hubbard died. And I don't know what would happen if Miscavige was gone. But, you know, he's only 58 and he seems to be in good shape. And he's got a mountain of money. So I don't really see him going anywhere time soon, unless the government decides to do something.
I mean, along those lines, it sounds like this decimation of his central executive group happened around the same time that Shelley fell by the wayside. Do you think that her disappearance has something to do with those same motives? And where do you think she is?
I think that's a good observation, that those early 2000s is when he really decimated the executive corps, and between 2000 and 2005, and most of them were gone by that time, and 2005 is when Shelley vanished. As to the particular reasons, I mean, I have eyewitnesses at the base that I've written about. You know, the story was that they had always gone everywhere together. Dave and Shelley. They were in L.A. at various facilities there, or they were at Int Base near Hemet, California. That was their primary location. Or they were in Clearwater together, or they were opening a new church. And there's a video where they're both at Madrid opening a new church there. They always went together. And then suddenly in the summer of 2005, Miscavige went to L.A. They were living at Int Base near San Jacinto, California, about 80 or 90 miles east of L.A., and Miscavige suddenly went to L.A., and the excuse was that he was going to work on this new set of books they were putting out that came out a couple years later. And, you know, people noticed. I mean, this is unusual that, right. You know, they're only 80 miles apart, but it's just really strange that Dave would go to L.A. and leave Shelley behind. And I think she was a little worried about it. Well, she decided as long as he's not there, she was going to take care of a couple of things that he never seemed to get around to, one of which was called the org board. And it's basically a list of jobs that need to be filled. You have to understand, if Scientology is a cult, it's a business cult, right? I mean, it's obsessed with bureaucracy. They have this fetish over rules and organizational charts. It's so boring. It's so incredibly dull. But that's what they obsess over. And so they have this job chart. And anytime they said, why don't we put this person here, this person there, he would just reject it. And, no, go do it again. And so she was tired of it. Everyone was tired of it. So while he was gone, she went ahead and filled in the names on the org board. The other thing she did, there were plans to to renovate his living quarters. And so she had all of his personal things crated up. so they could then get that work done. Maybe and someone else would come back to the base and say, hey, thanks, Shelley. Thanks for taking care of these things. He came back and blew his stack.
Ugh.
And I have, you know, eyewitnesses to this that he just went nuts. He was so angry that she had done these things. And a week later, she vanished. The other thing to keep in mind is something Mike Rinder saw that he told me about. He was also working on that book project in L.A. He made a trip out to Int Base, and he said Shelley just cornered him. And she seemed really agitated, and she asked him this really strange question. Which of his wedding rings was he wearing? Because apparently he had, like, three different medals, three different kinds of wedding rings.
Oh.
And Mike said he realized what she was really asking was he wearing his wedding ring?
Oh.
That's when he realized, this was before she disappeared, obviously, that's when he realized something was up, that she obviously considered herself in some danger. And sure enough, after the big blow up over the org board, she vanished.
Wow.
And that was in late August, early September 2005. Now, this is a person that had helped Dave run the organization and was at all the events. The only time she's been seen at a Scientology event or in public at all was 2 years later in the summer of 2007. She was allowed to go to her father's funeral. Other than that, she has not been seen. And we know where she is. We know where she's been this whole time. Int Base is this large management base east of Los Angeles near the town of Hemet, and it's, you know, kind of on the desert floor.
Okay.
There's a smaller compound up in the mountains near Lake Arrowhead. I don't know if you're familiar with Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's a much smaller little hidden compound up there. It's a location owned by a separate Scientology entity known as the Church of Spiritual Technology, CST. CST was started in the early 80s by L. Ron Hubbard, when he reorganized the church into an alphabet soup of individual entities. CST's job is to preserve L. Ron Hubbard's words for millennia. And so that little compound up in the mountains near Lake Arrowhead is the headquarters compound of CST. They also have, you know, small bases in New Mexico, Northern California, and Central California. At the headquarters compound near Lake Arrowhead, what they're doing there is the actual preservation work, where they're finding ways to use very expensive technology to put, like, Hubbard's words on steel plates and store them in titanium boxes.
Wow.
They actually put out a program about it on their new TV network recently. They and said their goal is to make sure that his words last at least the next 12,000 years. And the way they do that is they not only create these impermeable books and stuff, but then they have these vaults, these underground vaults at like four different places, including the one near Lake Arrowhead. And so that's where Shelley has been for the last 13 years, is working at that small compound, helping to preserve L. Ron Hubbard's words.
Wow.
Some will say, hey, she's a Sea Org member. She knows that's her job. It's actually a nice place. David Miscavige is not there yelling at people. It's a beautiful forest area. But it's a prison. She can never leave. He's banished his wife to this small compound where nobody will ever see her again except for the maybe 10 or 12 people that work with her. She can't see her family. You know, it's outrageous that he's been able to get away with this. I've talked to family that want to see her. I've talked to law enforcement about that, and they won't do a thing.
Why is that? You hear about their war chest and all the money they have. Do you think it has gone to the level that they, you know, have people in power that help them get away with these types of things?
I don't know if it's that they have people in power, but, you know, they've spent a lot of time doing what L. Ron Hubbard called safe pointing, which means that they get to know people in these organizations and they, you know, provide help. And they, you know, people see that they sue, and, you know, these officials learn over time. We don't want to tangle with them.
Right.
It's not that they're directly being bribed or anything like that. It's just, you know, Scientology works on those relationships. You know, Mike Rinder once explained to me, said, imagine you're like a mid-level government officer somewhere in some agency that might possibly have some jurisdiction over something Scientology's doing. And you decide, you know what, we need to go in there and find out what's really going on, maybe confiscate some documents and interview some people, maybe file some charges. He said, if you're that mid-level bureaucrat, you basically have to decide, are you ready for that to be the rest of your career?
Right.
Because that's all you're going to be doing, is fighting them and their high-priced attorneys And they fight dirty. Yeah. I mean, we see it again and again. They not only will that mid-level bureaucrat have to deal with Scientology's very aggressive lawyers, but they'll get into his private life. Right. And all of a sudden, he'll find out his wife is being harassed at her job. I mean, this is what they have been doing for 60 years. It's the only thing they know how to do because Hubbard wrote it all down in the 60s. They literally have a manual for how to fight their enemies, and they follow it to the T even today.
Wow. So what have they done to you? It feels like you would have to be pretty close to enemy number one with all the reporting you've done.
No. There's lots of people that are more important to them. Ron Miscavige has really been a thorn to them.
Because yeah.
What about his own son, Leah and Mike, and their show has been so huge, and they've done an amazing job. I do deal with that. I talked to Leah about it on her show. I talked to Alex Gibney about it a little bit on his in a movie Going Clear. They do try to make my life uncomfortable, and they do the classic Hubbard thing. They go after my loved ones. You know, they just it's scummy. I told Leah the worst thing they ever did was they actually hired an out of work newspaper reporter to pretend he was working on a story about my wife in order to scare her employers.
Oh.
I mean, it's just so scummy, and you know, and it's just constant online and all this garbage, but. You know, the best thing is just to ignore it, because I think people are pretty quick to see, oh, that's Scientology saying that about Ortega. Okay, I don't care what they
think. Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's all a bunch of lies and smears and garbage. But, you know, it does drive some people away. I personally know of some journalists that came into the field gung-ho, and then Scientology started looking into their private life, and whoop, they're gone.
Right. Well,
you know,
it seems like we need more people that are willing to tolerate it, though. I mean, especially even in those mid-level positions. You think about somebody like Shelley, but then you also think about some of the scarier cases. I mean, like McPherson. Scientology, I know you said they aren't in the habit of killing people. That's not what they do. And I know any cases of that are super, super rare where they could even be tied to it. But what they're doing is pretty terrifying from a psychological standpoint.
I mean, she died of neglect. There's no question.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no question. But they thought, see, Hubbard in 1971, I think, came up with this idea that, you know, you see him quoted earlier than that. He's quoted numerous times in lectures and interviews saying, you know, we don't deal with the mentally ill. We're taking the able and making them more able, right? And it was smart of him to do that because it's the able who have money, right? So he didn't want to deal with the problem cases. But I think he realized that if he was going to proclaim himself the world's expert on the human mind, you can't ignore the people that have mental problems. So in 1971, he decided that he had come up with a way to cure psychosis. And it was simply to lock a person in a room with no stimuli. Don't talk to them. Just give them some food and they'll come out of it. I mean, it's the most barbaric medieval approach to mental health you can imagine. But they are convinced that this thing he came up with, he called it the introspection rundown, is the way to handle somebody. And so when Lisa McPherson broke down and you know, had a mental incident and she went to the hospital, and the Scientologist showed up and said, no, we'll take care of her. They then locked her in a room, and she was nuts. I mean, she was hitting people and just doing outrageous stuff, but they just said, here's your food, eat it. They wouldn't talk to her. You could never talk to her around her, which must have just completely infuriated her.
Ugh.
And 17 days later, she was dead.
Yeah.
And see, they thought, well, Hubbard says this will cure her. And so, you know, I think they could see with their own eyes that this woman was deteriorating every day, but they didn't have the training to, you know, believe their own eyes. You know, well, Hubbard says she'll get better. So, no, I don't think they tried to kill her, but they did kill her through their neglect. It's a very horrible story,
right.
And she deserved a lot better than that. And that was a huge scandal at the time. The church was actually charged criminally for a while.
How did they win that case?
They spent so much money. Marty Rathbun estimated they spent $30 million trying to influence judges and attorneys and criminal, you know, law enforcement agencies. And they put so much pressure on the medical examiner. She finally second-guessed herself, changed the manner of death, and died early. I mean, you have to understand, when Scientology really wants to put pressure on someone, it's incredible. You know, it's such a miscarriage of justice. And I think Florida and California in particular are two states that are just not prepared to deal with Scientology and its tactics. I think some other states are a little better about it. I think they don't get away with as much in places like Texas and New York.
Right.
Something about California and Florida, just they just cannot handle a group that's this. I think that the core American courts with large organizations that have a lot of money assume there's going to be some sort of acting in good faith, and they're just literally not prepared to deal with a group like Scientology that's so dishonest in court and gets away with it time and time again.
Yeah, but my God, it's been going on for so many years now. You think it's just strange to me that there isn't somebody who's willing to stand up and do something. I mean, part of me wonders with all of this that's going on and, you know, a combination of the much broader coverage of the evils of Scientology and, you know, some of the trends that I at least see from reading articles. Do you think that Scientology has passed its prime, or do you think it's still gaining traction? Do you think
Oh, no. Scientology's on its deathbed. I mean, you know, the best it was ever doing was around the year 1990 had grown to maybe 100,000 people worldwide. They've never had the millions that they always claim. Never. But then the story on the cover of Time magazine came out in May 1991, and it started to decline, and it sped up in the 90s. Miscavige, being so ruthless, has driven away a lot of people.
Right.
I told you about this recent defector. There's another recent defector who also had access to enrollment documents, and they both agree. These are recent defectors now, just in the last few years. They said, based on their own observations, that the worldwide active membership now is less than 20,000.
Wow.
This is a tiny organization with a mountain of money that is trying to make itself look like it's healthy. That's all David Miscavige does, is he opens all these new churches around the world to pretend like it's expanding when it's not. You're starting to see, especially in the last year, Mike Grinder is particularly good at documenting this. We're starting to see some real signs where he's having a hard time staffing places.
Mm-hmm.
Things are starting to get real kind of paranoid on a local level. There's no question that Scientology is in trouble. The only question is when is, you know, with the mountain of money that he has, the billions
right.
in liquid assets that David Miscavige has, you know, he is Scientology at this point. He doesn't need a membership. He's got control of all the trademarks and copyrights, all the money. He could keep this show going indefinitely. But clearly this organization is weaker than it was just 10 years ago. And thanks, you know, to people like Alex Gibney and Leah Remini and Mike Grinder.
Yep. And you, give yourself some credit.
Well, I just report things. You know, they're more of the activist types. But, you know, it's when is the government going to stop being so afraid? I mean, I know people at the IRS are sick of what happened in 1993 when the IRS basically caved and gave them tax exempt status.
Yep.
I know there are people at the IRS that want to review that and you know, look into Scientology. But, you know, it's always a tough, like under Obama, the IRS was under siege. It had some scandals and it really didn't have the resources to do something like this.
Right.
Under Trump, on the one hand, there was an interesting report that this close aide to Trump had told Leah privately that Trump was interested in removing the tax exempt status. But that private message was never really confirmed publicly.
Hmm.
And all Trump has done publicly has supported the idea that churches should be free of investigation, right. allowed to do what they want to do. So I'm skeptical that Trump wants to do something. But if he wanted to, all he's got to do is ask his secretary treasurer, Mnuchin, however he says his name.
Yeah.
He can order a review of that arrangement. I know there are people at the IRS that are ready to jump into that because Scientology is in violation of its agreement with the IRS every day of the week.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are plenty of people that would line up to give them out of evidence. So, you know, people always ask me, you know, how can they get away with this? How can they get away with that? It's never a question that Scientology is violating rules and breaking laws. They are every day. But it's when there's going to be the will on the part of the government to do something about it. And the fact that there's only 20,000 people actually works against that. Because, you know, a congressman is not going to go to war against Scientology when he's only going to get a few votes out of it. You know what
right.
I'm saying?
Well, and all that money, too. My God, if all they have to do is, you know, strategically donate to campaigns and they continue to ensure their safety, which is, you know, just a much scarier big issue. But you talk about how the church is shrinking and how it is so far on the decline. How do they maintain these celebrities and get these celebrities to keep giving so much money? I mean, the obvious ones that come to mind, Tom Cruise and John Travolta, continue to invest this money and seem to remain really enthusiastic about it. How do they keep them engaged?
Yeah. You know, the celebrity thing has been so good for them for so long, but now it's starting to become a liability because, you know, for the longest time, most of the public didn't really know anything about Scientology. All they knew that, you know, people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta are involved, and that's great for the church. But now you got actual celebrities coming out and speaking out about the Church of Scientology. Jason Begay was really right. The first, and then Paul Haggis, and then Leah Remini. I mean, she gets a lot of attention for what she's doing, and she knows what she's talking about. So this has become a big nightmare for them. As far as the celebrities that are still in, I often hear from people that assume Cruise and Travolta and Ali and these people, they'd love to leave, but they can't because of all the secrets that have been written down. You got to understand, they're true believers.
Really?
They believe this stuff.
That's scary.
They have accepted the idea that L. Ron Hubbard is the only human being to figure out the secrets of the human mind and the secrets of the universe. And that we are living on, you know, there's a scene in The Matrix is a very popular movie with Scientologists because, you know, you're living in this world and then suddenly the scales are pulled from your eyes and you realize you're just this meat body that's being used for electrical generation on this horrible prison planet. Right. That's what Scientologists have always said about Earth.
Yeah.
They've always believed that this is a prison planet. We don't realize that we're clueless. Only Scientologists have the wisdom and the intelligence to see what's really going on and try to save this place. And so they really look down their nose at all of us. That's another thing that's very important to keep in mind. Scientologists are very superior. They really think they're superior to the rest of us. We're a bunch of dumb idiots that don't realize. Once you buy into that idea, it's a very powerful idea. Because then imagine in The Matrix, if somebody was saying, "You're such a jerk. How can you believe that this is really a prism?" You, as the audience, you think, ha, 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 you shouldn't listen to that person. That's how Scientologists feel. Anybody that comes to them and says, you know, this cupboard guy was a crank. There's nothing to this. Scientology's a joke. Why are you brainwashed? That actually makes them embrace it even stronger.
Right. It proves their case in their mind.
It proves their case in their mind. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that goes for the celebrities. They believe it. Now, some of the younger celebrities grew up in it. And what I found that's interesting is that in a lot of their cases, you check their completions. We can actually look up how many courses they've taken in Scientology. Scientology publishes it themselves, right? We get a hold of it. And you often find that the second generation Scientologists, people like Elizabeth Moss or Erica Christensen who grew up in it, often will not have much progress on the bridge at all. And I always feel it's like, well, they don't have anything to prove. They're royalty, right? They grew up in it.
Right.
Nobody's ever going to accuse them of not being a Scientologist. And so, you know, the first generation, the people that come, that join, you know, Travolta and Cruise and Ali, they're all high up on the bridge. They're all OT 6 or 7. The other celebrities that join, they're all way up. You know, Chick Corea's done OT 8 twice.
Oh my
God. That's top of the level. But the younger ones that grew up in it, some of them aren't even clear. I've always wondered what keeps them in. Is it, you know, because, and I think they're a little bit more vulnerable. If they haven't even gone clear, they're not really involved in courses. They're only in it because they grew up in it. I think there's a possibility that they might take a longer look at Scientology and realize that it's not really beneficial to them. But for the most part, no, you're not seeing very many celebrities come out other than Leah.
Right. Well, the cynical side of me, of course, thinks, okay, well, if you're young and you're in the church, you see somebody like Danny Masterson and you say, well, I mean, if I screw up, obviously they're going to spend their war chest to go to bat for me. So I suppose there's a benefit in that.
Yeah, it's hard to know for sure with Danny's case. There's no question that, you know, Mike Rinner's talked about people like John Travolta have definitely benefited from Scientology going to bat for them when they get into some legal problems. Danny Masterson is an interesting question because we don't know if he's going to be charged. The DA is taking forever to make up their minds. And, you know, he's got his own money. He's got a very good attorney. He's got very aggressive attorneys. It's hard to know how much Scientology is involved in that.
Right.
You know, I talk to some people saying, you know, as soon as he's charged, the church is going to wipe its hands of him. Who knows?
Really?
I don't know. Because, you know, we'll find out when that happens because it's taking forever, but the DA still hasn't said anything.
Do you think they could be taking forever because there's some kind of pull, because there's some kind of, God, should we really do this? Again, this mid-level government idea, do we want to go up against Scientology? Is this going to be more trouble than it's worth?
Well, I mean, look at the nature of it. You've got four women who have come forward saying that he violently raped them. And it was, you know, quite a while ago, between 2001 and 2004. I think in a just sort of all by itself, a prosecutor, and I've asked prosecutors about that, and they would say, look, this is a challenging case. Right. A lot of time has passed. You're talking about four women and their memories. You know, these are not easy cases and maybe not an easy decision. But look what era we're in right now, the Me Too era. How much time did it take to charge Harvey Weinstein?
Right.
And for Harvey, it was the same thing. It was, you know, allegations of sexual abuse from about the same period. And yet he was charged in a couple of months. And the women who were what came forward on that say they've been treated so well by the New York Police Department and they were listened to. And this case is like going fast. And so then you have to ask, okay, well, if that's the situation, and in L.A. they've got four women, and as the Daily Beast showed the other day, there's evidence from that time, really crucial evidence showing how much the church knew about all this. I mean, there's a lot of evidence in this case. So then you have to wonder, okay, what's taking so long? And I don't think you can just dismiss the idea that they are very concerned about charging a Scientologist and that, you know, Scientology was very involved in this case.
Yeah.
Law enforcement is very skittish about Scientology. They have a reputation for really making law enforcement miserable. I don't know. At this point, it's getting so long, it's getting kind of ridiculous. And from Danny Masson's perspective, too, I mean, Danny Masson deserves to know if he's going to be charged or not so he can go on with his life.
Right.
Jackie Lacey needs to make a decision. You know, I keep hearing it's going to be soon, but I've been hearing that for a year.
Yeah, it has. It's been a really long time. I guess speed of trial is not an issue when you're looking at it from all of those different angles, I suppose. But, you know, I look at, you were talking about some of the other young members of Scientology, Elizabeth Moss. I always, for whatever reason, I'm a big Beck fan. So I always go to Beck. And I remember when I found out Beck was a Scientologist, I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? How is that possible? He seems so smart. And I think he's a second generation too, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'll have to do some research. Hopefully he's one of those that really hasn't gone far up the bridge either. My fingers are crossed.
He is not. And I don't know that he does much Scientology at all, and he doesn't talk about it very much, but the few times he has, he's defended it and said it's good for my life, blah blah blah. But he's one of those ones I wonder, you know, might he see the light someday? I don't know. It's one of those things where he grew up in it. He's a very successful person in his life. He probably doesn't want to get involved in any fights one way or the other.
Right. It's more like, let's not rock the boat. So this is kind of a random question. One of the other couples that I've read about that have a ton of money and seem to be pretty heavily involved are the Duggins.
Duggins.
So Bob and Trish Duggan, this ghost town that they bought in California a couple of years ago. Of course, my conspiracy brain loves to think, like, what are they doing? Are they going to try and build a compound out there? Is this more of like what the CST is doing? Do you have any knowledge of anything that's gone on? Because I can't find anything since they actually purchased the property. Is there anything going on at Holy City?
That's a good question, because they split up after they bought that.
Oh, interesting.
I think she got that. And her idea is kind of an art center, I think. She's really into the arts, and there was kind of an art colony there to begin with. And I think what I'd heard was she wanted to kind of make that kind of a mecca for artists, and it didn't really sound like it was going to have anything to do with Scientology.
Damn it. Okay.
What's much more controversial about them is that, I mean, this Bob and Trish Duggan were wealthy Scientologists, but they actually had a son who died of cancer. And so Bob, to his credit, started trying to find ways to use his entrepreneurial skills to help with cancer research. And he did really well. I believe it was some kind of a technology for sort of helping with surgery or something. But anyway, it did really well. And so he stayed in that field. And then he really struck it big when he took over this company that was trying to get a cancer drug to market, which is incredibly difficult, very expensive. And after he had bought the company, it was called Pharmacyclix, they just really struck it big because that drug turned out to do really well in trials. So suddenly they were just sitting on this gold mine. He ended up selling Pharmacyclix to a company called AbbVie for $21 or $22 billion.
Oh, God.
His personal wealth went to about $4 billion at that time, according to Forbes magazine. For what we saw over several years was that in October, David Miscavige has this special big event where he really rewards the biggest donors. Mm-hmm. And they have set up levels. You know, maybe over your lifetime in the church, you've given $1 million. But once you pass $2 million, you get this new status and a big trophy, right? It's a cumulative thing. It's not like, oh, here's a trophy because you gave us a check this year. No, it's like you need to pass these milestones. And so there's milestones at 100,000, 250,000, 500. And, you know, most people are just trying to get to the million level. Well, the Duggins had blown past that for so long. They had to invent all these bizarre status level names like Invictus, Platinum Invictus, you know. And they stopped publishing what those levels were worth like 10 years ago. So we're just trying to calculate based on some, you know, basic sort of math, like where must they be now? And I was trying to be conservative, and I was actually working with somebody that had actually worked in that department. So he knew what was what.
Wow.
And the last we got to was that the last trophy they got, we figured represented about 80 million just for that one particular way of giving. It's called the IAS. But they've also clearly given millions more for building projects around the world. Forbes said that Bob Duggan has given something like $300 million to the Church of Scientology. But I don't know where they got that number. Yeah. That may be true, but I think it's probably, you know, I personally can see about $100 million in giving. But they're so far off the charts above any other Scientologist. Well, then in the middle of all this, they split up.
Yeah. So what happens when somebody splits up in the church? Like, is there a disconnect with one of them, or do they both get to stay in?
Well, this last October, Miscavige gave the same trophy that he'd given before. That's another departure from custom. You're supposed to, like, go to the next higher level, right? He gave the same Invictus trophy again, and it was only Trish on stage with him.
Ooh.
It's more intriguing. Now, the other thing that Bob and Trish did while they were breaking up, they had had this foundation in their name for quite a while, several years, that had nothing in it. You can look up the records. It was an empty organization, Bob and Trish Duggan Foundation. The last week of 2015, like December 20th, 2015, suddenly they put in $60 million worth of AbbVie stock. See, when he sold his company to AbbVie, you know, as they do, these wealthy people, he took a mixture of cash and stocks, right?
Right.
So he takes $60 million worth of AbbVie stock, and they put it into that foundation. And in the bylaws, I mean, in the document that they submitted to the IRS, it says they expect conservatively that this money is going to return about 5% a year. So that's $3 million right. every year. And it says the grants from this foundation can only go to the Church of Scientology or one of its subsidiaries.
Oh, wow.
Now, what is AbbVie? AbbVie is one of the biggest drug makers in the world, and their number one drug is the number one drug in the world. It's, I just blanked on it. It's the rheumatoid arthritis drug. What's it called?
Entyvia or
no,
Remicade?
No, it's Humira.
Oh, yeah.
Humira is the number one drug in the world. It's made by AbbVie. They also make a bunch of other drugs too, including Depakote, which is a psychiatric drug used bipolar. So it's so hypocritical
wow.
because Scientology hates psychiatric drugs, and here this company that makes psychiatric drugs and Humira, as long as that company's doing well, Scientology is going to get $3 million a year forever.
Wow.
Just from that one
source. Wow. That's terrifying. That is so terrifying.
And of course, if AbbVie does better, if Humira does better, and the stock goes up, they'll have even more money. I think that's probably one of the two or three biggest stories I've reported in the last 2 years that the rest of the media has completely ignored. That one of the, you know, a billionaire set up a foundation so that Humira is going to power Scientology into the indefinite future.
That's insane and completely terrifying. Like,
incredible. And there's nothing AbbVie can do about it.
Yeah. it's really hard not to think too. I mean, when you mentioned that you're the only person that told this story, nobody else in the mass media did. It's really hard not to think that there's something to that. I mean, because it's not like people wouldn't be interested in reading that. That's a phenomenally important story, and the fact that it's not picked up, it's hard not to go to a conspiracy place.
And they don't have to believe me. The document is sitting there. Anybody can pull that document down from GuideStar.org at any time. Bob and Duggan Foundation. Their 2015 IRS filing, it's right there. $60 million worth of stock. Grants can only be made in the Church of Scientology, right there.
Of course, it's the same with this new case with Laura DeCrescenzo, the abortion case that they decided to settle because they finally decided they were too scared to go to trial. Nobody's covering that either.
That really frustrated me because Laura's story is so incredible. And it's just been sitting there in court documents for years. She sued in 2009. Over the fact that she joined the Sea Org at 12 and was working 90 hours a week for basically no pay at 12 years old. She was punished for missing her mother. She had to go through intense interrogations just to see her grandparents. I mean, all these horrible things. And then ultimately when she was 17 and still under their control, they forced her to have an abortion. And this is one of the central things that Scientology had a policy that Sea Org women could not have children. And so many women have come forward and said, yeah, they would force us to have an abortion. She filed her lawsuit in 2009. It's taken 9 years to get to a trial because that's what Scientology does. They threw everything at her. They threw every delay tactic. You know, it was incredible watching this. I covered it for 7 of those 9 years. And I was the only one writing about it 90% of the time. Every once in a while, a courthouse news service would write something. A few other organizations would do something about it. But what drove me crazy was that the Los Angeles Times never said a word in 9 years. Everything that happened in this lawsuit happened in Los Angeles. The lawsuit was being litigated in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Times had no interest. And I knew this was going to happen once the word came that the settlement happened. What did the LA Times do? They just ran an AP story, case settled. And it's just a shame to me.
Do you think there's something to that, though? Because it's not a lack of interest in the community.
Right. I mean, people have said, the LA Times had such budget problems. It's not a budget issue. It's not an ownership issue. Editors know that if you run a story about Scientology, it will be well read. But as I've explained to people, there are journalists that don't think Scientology is a story worth covering. I don't know why. I mean, it has so many elements to it that I think are fascinating. I think Scientology gets to some of the roots about American law and American conceptions of ourselves, that they cynically take advantage of our most precious beliefs about freedom of religion and freedom of speech. There are fascinating things about Scientology besides just the fact that they're abusing people. But I have run into journalists that just think it's just not an important story, and I don't know if they think that the religion part of it turns them off or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, if you just have two or three of those sorts of journalists in a position of authority at the LA Times, that explains it. They just aren't interested.
Are they just oblivious to the TV and film that is getting such traction? Obviously, there's a huge market, even from, if it's not a humanitarian standpoint, even from a business standpoint, it just seems ridiculous.
I know. When I did my story breaking the news of the settlement the other day, and I made a point about that, okay, 9 years and not a single word from the LA Times. And I said, please, if somebody there can help me understand what's going on. And then I heard from a lot of people about how, it was bought by Tribune and all this. It's got nothing to do with ownership. There are editors there that, for whatever reason, are not interested in the Scientology story, which is most interesting in Los Angeles. I mean, there's also Florida. But, I mean, the other story I'm doing this week is about the 75-year-old man who was taken by Scientology. They ran up $73,000 worth of charges on his credit card.
I saw that. Ice cream and crazy things just to go out and yeah.
They used an ice cream visit with these young girls to get him to give them tons of money. And now he's trying to get his money back. He's struggling. That's happening right now in the city of Los Angeles. And here I am covering it from New York. Because the LA Times won't put a reporter on it. It's incredible.
Yeah. So one quick question. I know Scientology is illegal in the UK. Does it have a presence anywhere else in the world beyond America? I was thinking, especially in terms of the CST, do they do translations into any other language?
It's not illegal in the UK. Russia has tried to make it illegal, but it never sticks. I guess you're looking at, we had a story yesterday about how there was a ban in the UK, but it was kind of a selective ban. It was, no new people could come in and stuff like that. And it was poorly done. But it was banned in a few states in Australia in the 60s. There was this sort of nationwide but sort of partial ban in the UK, but that was taken away in the 80s. Russia has tried to crack down on it, but in a very extra legal way that's kind of scummy. Yeah. Hungary is doing some interesting things about the way Scientology misuses people's personal data. That's fascinating. In France, the highest court of the land upheld a fraud conviction of Scientology, which, you know, took many years to get that. Germany has been very they watch Scientology, let's put it that way. They tried to come close to banning, but they never do. But Germany made it tough for Scientology for many years, and they still keep an eye on it. It's really dying out in all these areas anyway. I mean, there's so few Scientologists left at this point. Sadly, one government that watches other governments and criticizes them for how they treat Scientology is the United States.
Yeah.
The United States State Department puts out an annual report that criticizes other countries for trying to do something about Scientology. It's really bizarre.
We've taken so much of your time, and I so appreciate it. I have one question I want to ask, and it seems like the obvious answer would be McPherson, but I'm wondering what you think, in all of the reporting you've done and all of the information you've gathered, what is the single worst thing you've seen Scientology do?
That's a good question. I think it's a class of things rather than one particular incident. I think it's disconnection that I just find so heartbreaking and terrible when you see what happened to, you know, the Headley family and the Sarah Goldberg and Cindy Plahuta, somebody I've written about, and, you know, Brian Sheen's never even been able to lay eyes on his own grandson, and Bernie Headley is you know, fighting cancer and hoping he lives long enough to see his daughter again. It's just sickening. It's so horrible. And there's no let up on that at all. I know Miscavige has been doing some cosmetic things lately to try to deal with some of the press criticism, but disconnection is still going strong. And I just find it so abhorrent.
It is terrifying. That was one of the things I've always imagined, how crazy Scientology is and, you know, how horrible it is. But starting to watch Leah Remini's show and seeing just the humanity that is absolutely gut-wrenching there. That's what scares me more than anything now after getting into it a little bit more. So, ugh. Well, quick question. I know you came out with a really interesting book a few years ago, The Unbreakable Miss Lovely. And are you working on a new book? Is there a new Scientology project? Obviously, the underground bunker takes a ton of time, so I doubt there's much time for anything else. But are there other big projects you're working on right now?
Well, The Unbreakable Miss Lovely was my book about Paula Cooper, who was one of the first journalists to write a book about Scientology. And she really paid for it. They tried to destroy her, and she spent years and years being targeted by elaborate operations by the Church of Scientology. And people had generally kind of known that nobody had gone through the fair game retaliation like she had. But I really had the privilege of getting to sit down with her and go through all the documents and really tell her whole life story. She then came to me late last year and said, you know, there ought to be a book of the best stuff from the Underground Bunker, your website. And so she and I are putting that together.
I love it.
Yeah, the two of us. And she's writing introductions. We have various sections, you know, chapters, stories about disconnection or celebrities. And she's actually writing the introductions to those. So that's been a lot of fun. And we're getting pretty close to getting it finished. And I think she said it would be out in September or October. So it's called Battlefield Scientology.
I love it. That's great.
and I think even people that have read our stories at you know, we tried to update the stories and add some things, and then we've got these introductory chapters. So I hope it'll be worth picking up even for people that are familiar. And also, it goes pretty far back. So some people that have just come to the bunker in the last, you know, year or two might appreciate seeing some of these stories that we've covered along the way.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. We'll make sure everybody knows about that. That's really great. So you said September or October. That's coming right
September,
up.
September, October, Battlefield Scientology.
I love it. Best title I've heard all year. That's fantastic. Oh my gosh. Well, Tony, thank you so much for taking the time, especially for somebody who's kind of top of the funnel understanding of this like me. It's just fascinating to hear you talk. And, you know, I know you don't give yourself as much credit as you should. It really is impressive to see what you're doing to try and bring so much of this to light and facing some significant trials and tribulations in your efforts to do so. So thank you very much. And
well, thank you for looking into it, because we're coming into a very interesting period over the next few months. I think it's going to get kind of gnarly. So just keep checking the underground bunker every day at TonyOrtega.org.
Yeah, I absolutely will. TonyOrtega.org. Thank you so much, Tony. Have a great afternoon, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an Audio Wool original, produced by Byron McCoy. Theme music provided by Cemeteries. For more programs like this, visit audiowool.co.